Thank you for listening to Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy. This is episode 68, Act 1, Jaron Herman, Pockets of Light, recorded December 2nd, 2023.
So damn tired of waiting on a perfect A plus B. The one size fits all prudent kids all screaming about irrevocability. Let's burn some bridges, earn some stitches, and fight our own way free. Cause the rules don't lie, but they don't apply to people like you and me. Let's start it up now. 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 Now they say it's all decided, all divided, all laid out. And the pushcart man with a three-part plan can't understand what you're shouting about. But when the paths they plow, the lives allowed are the only roads you can see. Just remember walls were built to fall for people like you and me. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now.
Hey, hey, TA Podians. Welcome to Teaching Artistry, powered by A Space Between. This podcast is researched, recorded, and produced on the unceded lands, water, and air stewarded by the Canarsie and Munsee Lenape peoples in what is colonially known as Brooklyn, New York. Thanks so much for listening and supporting this indie podcast. Invite your peeps, colleagues, and friends to join our global community and subscribe on SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any podcast player. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Teaching Artistry Podcast, and head over to teachingartistry.org to access episodes, guest bios, e-zines, merch, and more. So, y'all, I am still kind of floored that we are in the seventh season of this podcast. Thanks again for listening and being a part of our community. It's February. And did you know that February, amongst other things, like it being Black History Month, there's also a National Library Lovers Day. And my mother, Rosalind Boddy, was a Black woman. And she was a librarian. And February is her birthday month. So I felt it was very fitting to honor and uplift libraries and librarians now that I know that there is a thing called National Lovers, Libraries Lovers Day. So my company did a social media campaign and invited people to talk about memories from their hometown library, and it was a very cute, sweet video with multiple staff members and their kids and me. and then when I filmed it, though, I gave a fuller version of my memories, and so I posted that to social media on my mom's birthday and gave a shout out to my hometown library, which is Port Washington Branch Library. And this lovely campaign, this little social media campaign, just unlocked so many great memories of being at the library, how central the library was to my entire existence from being, you know, literally a baby all the way up to grad school. And my mom volunteered for the library. I mean, there were events that were there, the beautiful children's library as part section, but it was like, it's huge. And there's like story time and teaching artists and a little jungle gym was in there and microfiche. I remember watching all sorts of, you know, movies, but like in microfiche. So it was just like still images of the movie. And I heard the audio, but oh man, it was Heidi and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory and Sound of Music, I think, was on there. I don't know. I just have so many memories of, like, sitting and reading and exploring the different parts of the library and being so enamored of, like, libraries have a smell, right? Like, books have a smell. Library books have a smell. There's just something about that. And then the computer lab and the being able to take out, like, when DVDs became a thing and CDs became a thing that you could borrow. Like, the very idea that no matter who you are or where you came from, when you walk into a library, it's a great equalizer, right? We're all here to use the resources, to do the research, to read the book, find the necessary reference books, chat with people about books, read quietly, have a safe, warm place to learn and grow and maybe engage. And I don't think I really understood. I don't think I fully understood, like, I actually remember searching for colleges at the library because I had no clue where I wanted to go. And my dad gave me a little bit of direction. Who was, basically, he was like, you're going to a state school or a community school, pick. So then I, you know, that narrowed down the search, but then it was like, which one, where, how far? New York State is a very big state. I've never been anywhere outside of Long Island. Like, what? And the library really helped me sort of narrow down where I wanted to apply and ultimately where I chose to go. But it made me, like, have to think, and it was a safe place to do that sort of big, scary, unknown thinking. And then when I was in grad school, I had left and come back. I was living in Port Washington, and I would do work there at the computer lab, and then I'd, like, take out books. And then I also went to the library on my campus, and I spent a lot of time there. Anyway, libraries are great, don't you think? We got to protect them. We got to preserve them. These are very important institutions. New York City has a huge number of libraries. I don't tend to spend a ton of time in libraries nearby, like in New York City. I just recently found out that there's one at the end of my block, and I'm curious about going there. I've been to the main branch. I love the Midtown Manhattan Library. That's close to my job. So, yeah, I have just, like, a lot of fond memories of libraries. And my mom, at working as a librarian, she worked at Marymount College at the very tail end of her career. And I think she really liked working in a college environment, having apprentices and, like, sharing her love of, I don't know, categorizing and cataloging and helping people find what information they are seeking with the young students. And actually, oh, I'm remembering this now, that they used to have, like, job postings, and I literally would just show up at her job. I would just show up at her job and be like, hey, can I hang out in this library and, like, look for things? And I was looking for a job outside, out of college. I really wanted to work in theater. And she's like, I think I found something. And because my mom worked in a library and had access to these job postings, I got my very first job in theater. Ah, wow. So anyway, libraries are great. Let's keep them going. All right, let's move forward, because I think I could just keep babbling about that. But I want to not babble anymore and think about Jerron Herman, who is our next guest. Jerron, what an amazing human. Like, I can't wait for you to listen to this conversation, because it's just so us, the two of us. So I've known Jerron for over a decade. John is incredibly thoughtful, beautiful, a bright light, full of light, and it just shines all over you, and you're just stardusted and the better for engaging with him at any time you can. So in this episode, we hear more about how we've engaged over the years and our initial meeting and what that meant for Jerron as he was growing as a young professional in unexpected ways. And also, we learn in this episode how he was seen growing up as a human with a physical disability. Here is episode 68, Act 1, Jerron Herman, Pockets of Light. Hello, Jerron.
Hi, Courtney.
How are you?
I'm doing so well. Thank you.
Good. Well, welcome to Teaching Artistry Podcast. This is a podcast that celebrates artists, culture, and equity. And I am very excited to learn more about your journey through arts, arts education, community engagement, etc. Are you ready? Tell us how you're doing in this moment. How are your loved ones? What's the vibe?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I appreciate always a check-in. I think it's like definitely one of the things that I am doing professionally, like all the time, is checking with the self, the human, because we're all humans and we definitely need to check in. My family's okay at this point. I'm really excited to see them for the holidays coming up, and it's my semi-annual jaunt to the West Coast to see them. It's my cousin and me who were here from the fam on the East Coast, and we have a lot of family in Baltimore, but it always feels like I'm the maverick, you know, going back and forth. And so I recognize that it's like, just like how I'm talking to my family is really more invigorated these days just because of the distance. And what else to say about fam? Everyone feels good. Everyone's doing well. We have some things that we're coming to terms with, as every family is, that I think is really fertile for growth in how we just are going to be together. I'm a independent artist right now. I'm an interdisciplinary artist. I usually work in dance as a performer and a choreographer. Mostly New York City. I make works that really center disability and Blackness and the relationship to those two tenants. But then also I'm really interested in the collaboration or connection between antiquity and modernity. I just was always an art history nerd, and I just love to see how contemporary stories kind of filter into the canon and our sense of, you know, what's rooted. In addition, I'm a director now. I'm directing a new opera called Sensorium X, which debuts in 2025, and just kind of hanging out. I'm writing, but I'm also just hanging out with other people, other kinds of entities. I'm working out with some museums and some cultural institutions. I'm just trying to figure out how to be really ubiquitous, but not in the sense of like everyone knows, needs to know my name. It's more like I'm really in this investing in me space where I just want to feel and be connected to so many different things so that I can learn.
We know each other. We've known each other for a while. You applied to be an apprentice at the New Vic. And I think then you were in college and you identified very specifically as a writer. Yeah. And so the journey between like being a writer, dancer, now choreographer, dancer, I'm sorry, director, you know, like the evolution of that, I feel is a very good story. So I can't wait to hear all about that. The other way that we intersect is, I project lead on a partnership project called GIVE, which stands for Growing Inclusivity for Vibrant Engagement. And it provides, a whole, suite of resources to support, mainly arts educators, teaching artists, arts teachers, et cetera. To think intentionally about building liberated learning spaces for students, but could be applicable to pretty much any space or any learning space at least. And you've been very deeply involved in that project as an independent contractor, consultant, and building out our what I like to call our give world, maybe even a universe. So that's how we've been intersecting in most recently. And then you also used to work at a dance company that we've presented before. So that's how I know you. And I've always been like, whoa, since meeting you from like that first semester or that summer, I think it was summer. I was just like, this person is so, there's a bright light inside and something at that time, what I could see, something was holding it back. I don't know what, but I feel like that's not the case anymore.
I was so enthralled by you the first minute I met you. Incredibly enthralled. I just wanted to be in your orbit so much because I just, similarly, there was this light and there was this this command that you always had around New Vic that I just was so encouraged by. And then, yeah, just you in the meetings and everything. I mean, so I'll tell you, yeah, as a young artist, creative, it was nothing but a joy to be able to just watch you work in that early stage. And so I'll say that really, like, that experience, so you are kind of the fulcrum of a lot of activity for me. I was an apprentice in the education department where I'll be honest, I wasn't the hottest intern or the best one. I wasn't the best one. I recognize there was something around arts education or like the office that maybe was, I don't know. I hadn't learned how to really be an effective worker in that space at the time. And so when it became time to almost end, there was that opportunity with Sean Curran to be a part of his studio weeks. And I learned that, I'm a kinetic learner. I need to be up. I need to be doing in order to kind of ground it in my body. And so I recognized that kind of everything maybe discursively or, however else I was taking information of the environment, it really all kind of funneled into that one week where I was able to be of service to someone and to understand how to connect dots to be, you know, to help curriculum development, all these things that we had learned in the abstract. Was like it all settled there. And to your point about like kind of holding back, I think there was an element of writing that I did as a consolation because I wasn't sure about my capacity to be a performer with a disability at the time. And there was, though not like explicit kind of discrimination against that, there was just the raised eyebrow or the, you know, the thinking that, oh, maybe not, you know, we just have the imagination. Although I definitely wanted to be a part of the Broadway community and the theater community in New York, it was so important to me. I just thought, however I could be a part. So when Sean invited me to dance for him and then brokered an audition for Heidi Latsky Dance, where I was a principal member for 8 years, it changed everything. It changed my whole perception of what is possible. And just personally, really, it just became very personal. Like, oh, I have the ability to do whatever I want to, or at least the ability to try.
Thank you for sharing that, because hearing it from your perspective, I know that there were some tough moments throughout your time, but I hope the way I was seeing you. And frankly, you know, there are other apprentices that were working that semester, but the way I was seeing was like, there's so many different kinds of projects. And so while I wasn't your direct mentor, there were projects that we could work on, and professional development was my thing, which is still, it's still in my portfolio. And so I was the one who ran those weeks. And I think there were two different weeks. One was dance and one was puppetry, and you were supporting from an admin perspective. But then I remember looking around the studio and being like, where's John? He needs to be in the room.
where is he? So I remember like coming down to the office and you were sitting at your desk and I was like, what are you doing? And you were like, oh, I have this thing that I have to write. And I was like, no, I need you in the room. And that was I think that was the start. And then it was like, and then you were in Sean's room and Sean was like, if you're in the room, you have to dance. And you were like, and then we, you know, so understanding the kinesthetic piece, that makes a lot of sense because so much of the projects that you were working on were not physical. They were on a computer and like creating in that kind of way, which may not work for everybody. Right. And so my biggest memory of that week or of that particular professional development week, when Sean asked you to do a solo as part of the larger piece of the whole. So basically, let me back up. So this is a professional development for teachers. It was accredited intensive that teachers who work for the Department of Education could get professional credit, which supports their salary differential in terms of learning. And but you know, that particular intensive, which you don't do anymore, that particular intensive was always like such a, like, we love it. I kind of miss it, but now we have other summer programming. But the beauty of it that I saw you have is the same kind of thing that I would see teachers have in those weeks, where they'd show up on the first day, super tentative, like, what do you mean I have to dance when you signed up for a class? The course title was Dance in the Classroom. And you're like, what? I have to dance? So they come in super like tight. And then by like midweek, they're like running through the hallway. They're leaping with no shoes and leotards. And they're just like, everything is like open and their heart. And it was just a beautiful thing to see. And it was without fail every single year that would happen. And that was different than like the puppeteers who were like more like into crafting, and they were just sort of like, you know. But then they went, so then the two courses, their culminating event was some sort of performance, and they would perform for each other, right? And so that's my memory, is that we're in this big studio and there's, you know, Sean is so good at taking the what does he do with his dancers? He has them create all the choreography, basically, and he stitches it together. So he's more of a curator than that's how he describes himself. But anyway, so my memory is, and I think I was dancing too, so I loved it because it got me to move too. So we, you know, we had different, you know, duets and trios and then whole group moments. And then there was this amazing solo, and I hadn't seen it. I don't think I'd seen it in rehearsal for some reason. And then you did it, and you literally just, I can't describe it any better, because this is my memory, is glowing. Like, you were moving and there was this glow that just kept getting bigger and bigger behind you. Like, and it was practically pushing you forward as you were moving downstage. That's my memory.
Oh my gosh. That's the story.
And the way you moved was like, I'd never seen you that free. Yeah. In the whole time, you know, in the 6 to 8 weeks that we were working together, I was like, oh my God, this is everything. This is everything.
Yeah. I mean, I will say that I felt free at the victory. In terms of the whole thing. I mean, of course, there's a kind of, you try to fit yourself into roles that you think you have to do. I think it was the first time, you know, as a young professional, that I was like, okay, there can be a way in which you are given a task that you don't have to fold yourself or keep yourself away, you know? And so if I walked out of that knowing that, like, there will be other jobs that I might not be kinesthetic, you know, or might not be that environment that I experienced with Studio Weeks, but yet I have to reconcile who I am with what I'm doing at every time. And so it was a really awesome opportunity. And I will say that solo moment, so from the performer side, just seeing everyone watch, you know, and like, they're even like knowing that like Madame Tussauds is right behind me. And so like Whoopi Goldberg and like Barbara Streisand and like, you know, Bon Jovi are like looking at me too, Beyonce. They're wax figures. So a bit of a witnessing, you know, of like what you're about to do next. And just, so I just, yeah, you're among the folks that like were at the start of what is now my career. And I just hold everyone, the nameless folks that I, you know, in that room, that I'm like, y'all were fam for that day in a really significant way. And so, yeah, that's that. Yeah. Yeah. It's a wonder.
You named earlier in terms of intersectionality, that you have a disability. And, you know, can you help us understand what that is and what that means for you?
When I think about disability work and disability in my work, I use the diagnostic language I was given as a child, which not every disabled artist does. So the one distinction I always like to make is that disability artistry or being a disabled performer or artist doesn't necessarily mean that you disclose your disability. I do because it's inserted into my work, which is the disability is hemiplegia cerebral palsy. And hemiplegia refers to the quadrant of my body in which the CP or cerebral palsy is affected or present, and which is the left side of my body. And so I've had this real connotation. Now I've started to create this connotation with hemisphere and the relationship to demarcation, land, power, how our society is kind of measured or kind of what segmented and in its own quadrants. It's just it's almost like the scene where you just see a bunch of zeros and ones and you start to see the matrix. You're just like, it all makes sense. Like, that's how my artistry has been evolving since I've really discovered, really in a kind of Zen way, my connection to everything. And so I think about the nature of fluidity and rigidity, or the qualities of my own personal movement that translate to choreography and to just to aesthetics in general, you know, in the course of in the arc of a show, do I have the rigidity and flow? In the sequence of a phrase, do I have that rigidity and flow? In the season that I have, you know, performing and curating and being, do I have that rigidity and flow? In terms of like understanding tension and release, weight and air. Just trying to find those elements throughout my whole activity stream.
Tell us about growing up. What kind of kid were you? How did you engage in the arts? How was your family around engagement, arts engagement, et cetera?
I grew up in the Bay Area of California, which was a really awesome place to grow up. It gave me a real sense of exposure to so many things, arts being one. But yeah, my family grew up in, my parents were both raised in San Francisco, and then my brother and I were raised in the East Bay in this small town called Alameda, which, you know, looking back, it's really an interesting thing because there was a growth point of upper mobility and kind of we were at the apex of like mid-90s, early 2000s, you know, Manifest Destiny almost, like just everyone from inner city moving to suburbs in order to like buy their first homes, do this, you know, do all of this this change. So we were kind of that, I would call it like a new migration almost, like just Black families going from this one set to this other set. And that kind of enlivened a lot. I grew up around a lot of different kinds of different people. Our neighbors, our second family was this Afghani family named the Jamis, who were, were our second family. And then, you know, in middle school, there were just so many different kinds of people that I was knowing. I was often a very outgoing kid. I loved to speak and to perform and to play. I was a little bit of a rebel, a little bit of like the one who asked the questions at the dinner table that no one really, you know, had time to talk about at second course. I'm the younger brother of two, younger son of two, and my older brother was the performer. He was an actor, and kind of our matinee idol as well. And so he really started the feeling of a life in the arts for all, my whole family. My parents are designers. They were always designers. And then I've just recently employed them as like my design team for my kids. Yeah. So kind of pulling them in. And so, yeah, there's always been this creativity of in my home. My parents always surrounded us with Black art. My aunts would always take us to the theater. So I just have really great memories of just being creative. You know, one, when I was starting out as a writer, my first story I wrote for, it was a Christmas present for my aunt Lumumba. And it was her present. And she starts to read it. I gave it to her. She starts to read it silently. And then she's like, oh, you know what? Let me like read it aloud. And so it becomes this whole performance. Her husband had like a, he's a musician. He has like a hand guitar. And so it's like, there's orchestration now. And then she's choosing voices and she's, you know, and I'm like 10 and this is my first time, like, and this is Christmas morning. And it's just like this swell of engagement with my own artistry for the first time. And then, you know, the family claps, you know, applauds for the ending of the story. And it just sits as like a real, you know, affirmation about what the arts can do. And it's come back because I've started to perform at places where my parents have lived. So my mom's from Baltimore originally. So I performed for her family. My family in Baltimore with one of my solos, and then took the same solo to San Francisco just this past August. So I just bring that up because it's like, I didn't recognize that part of my journey was to perform for my family. You know, I wanted to perform for other people, but I didn't recognize my family as my audience as well. And that's been a real big change.
Lovely. And so your older brother, your aunt, it seems like you actually have quite a creative family, the music and all. And so how about in school? Were you engaging in the arts at school or after school or?
Yeah. Yes. So my short stint as an actor in the children's theater of Alameda resulted in two plays. I was Christopher Robin in Winnie the Pooh. I was in Holes, and like a site specific version of Holes. We had we were out like on a real lot.
Ooh.
Yeah, it was method. And then my last like stint was a very controversial role or turn as Robert in The Rhymers of Eldritch in eighth grade, which is a court drama that involves sexual assaults, gambling, death, murder, all for eighth graders. So not too excited about me being in that show. I was an artist, Courtney. So that was my like short stint. But also like in general, I was super creative as a kid. I was always writing anything. I dabbled mostly in text at the time. It was all I could think about. In third grade, my teacher, Mrs. Andrews, was the one who spurred on my love for writing. She gave us an assignment every week to just write a page of prose and return it to her. She'd read it, she'd jot notes. But I really think that she made us writers to become readers. And so that we'd love text, you know, because we knew meter, we knew, you know, and then we also had our own connection to it. And it took, because she, I mean, her room was like where you went to be a reader or you went to be a writer. And so that was, yeah, that's what happened.
I liked writing a lot, actually. I had a lot of stories in my head I really loved reading. I came from also a pretty creative home, where literature was very important, theater, music. I don't remember going to museums, but like those three were pretty significant.
How did literature, like, or it's important?
I learned this later, but my dad as a kid was a voracious reader, and as an adult, but like as a kid, he used to do the Reader's Digest, like figuring out there's like some word finder thing, not a finder, but like you have to figure out words. So he would like read the dictionary and had the largest vocabulary of anybody I've ever met in my entire life. And he would love to read the classics, and he belonged to an organization called Great Books, which was like they would read a book and meet weekly locally. And then there was like a national version of that that would happen over the summer at Colby College. So every summer he would go up, and he was like a moderator, like a facilitator of those conversations. So he would like create, you know, the agendas and the big questions. And then he also was very religious. So he read the Bible and had lots of big, you know, theoretical theologian conversations at the dinner table. Yeah, it was kind of like going to college every day. And so, you know, on the one hand, like I really like reading what I like to read as opposed to what the classics weren't as interesting to me until I got more into acting. And then it was like, oh, this is a play. I love reading plays. Plays are very, very exciting to read because the thing about reading for me that I think connected was, I've learned this term more as an adult, but like the mind movie, like gets created from reading. And now I have like this beautiful bookshelf that has a curated, very curated shelf of books, but audiobooks are actually the way for me now. Like, I think because I'm a podcaster, everything, it's very interesting because when I was a kid, I couldn't just listen. I had to write it down or I had to like see it. And now the way I see things is by way of listening. And so it's sort of the same. It's sort of the same as when I was a kid and reading and would make these stories in my head, where I could see the images and see the things. And then it was weird when they would like adapt a book to a movie because I'm like, that's not how I pictured it. That's not right. Anyway, so that kind of literature was pretty massive in my life. But I didn't like, for me personally, I was not keen on people telling me read this or do this or you're so good at this, now go. And I, until I was the one who was like, I want that. You know what I mean? So I guess, yeah. And then for music, my parents also, like, they met by way of like singing. My dad taught himself to play the guitar in college, and that's actually I think how he got my mom, because he was like, he was working as an intern at a company that my aunt worked at, had a little crush on her. She invited him to a church jamboree, and he was like, oh, let me bring my guitar and like that might like entice her. And then she brings this lovely lady who happens to be her sister, and my dad is like, that's it, she's the one. And the way that my aunt tells the story is that, you know, my mom was quite shy, very introverted. And she sat down next to this young man who was like working in my company, and just sang with him all night. Yeah, so there's something about music that drew them together. And then they both sang at church. And so, yeah, there was always music playing in the household. And I played a little bit, and I like to sing. Never trained specifically, but I really like choir and chorus and that kind of thing. So yeah, so those things. And then theater, I think the reason why theater, two things that theater for me, like I identify as an actor and a director and a devisor now. And for me, I think I've analyzed this a couple of different ways, and I think where I am right now is what I want it felt like the most at home for me as some sort of creative to be on stage or to perform in any particular space. And two, nobody in my family was doing it. So all of a sudden it was like, I get to do this. I do this because I choose to do it. It makes a lot of sense for me, and nobody else is doing it and nobody else wants to do it, but you can come see me do it. So the idea of like performing for the family, them being your original audience, that completely resonates, because I would put on little shows, little scenes, skits before I went to bed. Sometimes nobody needed to be in the room. There were full on stories happening. I was playing every single character. It was, sometimes they were soap operas. Sometimes, okay, now I'm divulging a little too much, but sometimes as a kid in my brain, what was the scenario? The scenario was either we were in a play, it was rehearsal. We were in a play or we were filming on set. And so there would be like full stories happening off, like between scenes, and then we'd be doing scenes. So I would love to know more about, how are you seen in your family? How are you seen in school? How did you see yourself?
Well, I'll start with how my family saw me as a working partner in the family. Though, you know, not without its precious, like there was a relationship to my disability that my parents had to have, which looking back, they did some really awesome things without knowing, you know, like the disability justice of it all, you know? So I remember that they were big advocates on, you know, on undermining surgeries, for example, because in those, I'm telling you, mid 90s, they were all about just reconstructing your tendons, reconstructing everything, just like cut. And my parents were like, I think that he's going to be growing out of some of these things that you think you need to intervene with for surgery. I had a club foot, for example, and the doctors wanted to cut something so that like it would realign. And then my club foot went away, you know, or like it, I, yeah. And so there were things that my parents really intervened on, really. And funnily enough, similarly with their religious background and our faith background, their identification of the body's whole and as it is was their driving force for like why there was no difference, there was no kind of sense of lack of humanity or lack of, you know, presence or purpose in me, and so they were very averse to medical industrial complex because they didn't see me as whole. You know, the complex didn't see me as whole. So they were like, this, our baby's whole. Which I now know is like a bioethic, in the field of bioethics is also a thing in terms of disability and then personhood. So it's funny connection that's like actually scholarship. And then my peers definitely saw me as unique, you know. My biggest memory of kind of being with others of my age and was having to negotiate the language of my disability. I created a script very early on about, because the question in theater, their line was, "What's the matter with your arm?" My response would be, "What do you mean?" They would be like, you know, oh, it looks this way or it looks that way, or you have a limp. And I would say, oh, I have cerebral palsy. It's a muscular, it's a neuromuscular disorder that affects the left side of my body. I like had to come up with like multi-syllabic words, polysyllabic words. Is that the word? And then put into layman's terms, you know, I had to say things like, well, it makes me walk like this. And so I was always explaining on the way to the wall ball court or on the way to tetherball or, you know, at recess. So that script just was on replay. And then I think that after the introduction, after the shock, I was always a shock. I always felt like a shock to people. Then it's kind of subsided into like, oh, you like this game with us, or you can run, or you can play basketball. It was always about convincing other people of my capacity. And so, yeah, a lot of it was about me showing, like, having imagination for myself. You know, I think there was a lot of, which is why I find such solace in art, because it's a place of imagination and imagining. My teachers were advocates from the get. I mean, my third grade teacher, well, all of them were successful in advocating for me in different ways. Like I said, Mrs. Andrews, my third grade teacher, was like the first, was the first teacher that I loved. Like, was the first teacher that I just had so much love for, in the ways that she saw me as a person, and just keyed into, keyed into specialness in me. And I'm sure she did that for a lot of my classmates, but it was the first time I felt that I was the only one in the room. And then Mrs. Norman, who's the only Black teacher at my school in fifth grade, was a champion and such a graceful person, such a impactful person, who on our fifth grade graduation wrote a beautiful poem about everyone in the class and then ended on me and broke into tears. So with joy and with, you know, with reflection on how I had impacted her life. And so that was the first time that I recognized that I could influence my educators, or that I could have, you know, been a contributor to my education and to this adult world, which was really surprising to me. So, I just relished education and the environment so much, for so many different reasons. You know, I still think even about the architecture of an elementary school and how important it is to have like sinuous lines and, you know, pockets of like of light that just stream in on you as you're walking to the library, or like, you know, just these little things that are so important to the inwardness of a student, of a scholar. It changes when it has that little bit of intention. For example, just to end on this, Mrs. Andrews, again, she had these portraits in the library. I didn't know who had made them beforehand, but they always met me with such awe. I was always in awe of them. They were these professional line drawing covers of our books, you know, Dances with Wolves, Lord of the Flies, Island of the Blue Dolphins, you know, these classics. And it was the Lord of the Flies one with the face just coming through the brush that was the first time I was interacting with art, and imagining and dreaming and being really confronted by the beauty and the mystery of something that I didn't know was there, that was there for me, you know, and there for the school environment. But yeah, so disability factored into that in a way of like, I guess to be real, I hit it. I wanted to be also very normal, normative. Didn't want to engage in disability. My parents were big advocates and like, hey, you should like find a group, find people that look like you that have this your similar experience. But I was not interested because I just didn't feel like there was a similar experience at the time. And I just thought that I would be held back in some way if I went forward in approaching my identity. So I was really reticent to claim disability for a long time. And it was about overcoming. It was purely about overcoming as a kid.
When did you feel like you claimed disability?
When I was 21, 22, in the dance company, in Heidi Latsky's company, wherein I'm now dancing with other people with disabilities.
This is so helpful. I think it's interesting because how I know you, I knew you as you were embracing, I guess, you know, like that. So, and I have always felt like, I remember in that interview, when you said that you created a script, that completely makes sense to me, having had interfaced with you in that sort of pinnacle moment. Because I remember in the interview, you being so clear, crystal clear about what was going on with your body and like how you saw yourself as a creative, and how, you know, there was just a lot of clarity in certain ways in that interview. And then I've also seen you talk at talkbacks with young people, and the clarity with which you're explaining what's happening, what your disability is, and how you manifest as a creative. You know, it's not about showing capacity necessarily. I don't think that's the drive, right? It feels more embracing, like, I don't know if that's the right word, but that's what I always felt, at least at the time in my memories, feeling like, oh, the way Jerron talks about this is from this place of knowing and inviting. That's it, inviting. That I don't always hear folks who are advocating for the disability community or themselves. I don't always feel that invitation. It feels more, it feels different. Feels different. And I feel like there was a lot of learning that I had from listening to you in those times, specifically in those talkbacks, which I think it was somewhere in the mid-20 teens. and a precursor to the work that we've been doing with Give, you know, and as a theater too, growing in our understanding of what inclusive practices looks like from you know, the theater audience experience, audience engagement, both in viewing a particular piece of work and being in the spaces, the theater spaces, and in the content that we're delivering. And digitally, all sorts of things. And that's an ongoing, effort, you know, and growth area, because there's always new places that we can be pushing, new edges to be pushing towards. And so when you said earlier about disability justice, you also used a term that I didn't know, which was bioethics, I think you said. Yeah. Could you talk about, like, what is disability justice and what is bioethics?
Disability justice is a framework of 10 principles that was first originated or coined by Patty Byrne and an organization called Sins Invalid in the Bay Area. And the 10 principles incorporate like interdependence, I think cross-solidarity movements, anti-capitalism. What are some other ones? I love the one interdependence, particularly collaboration, you know, and so with that, the goal is to create a space, or always having these principles reframe, rework ableist environments, or environments that aren't inviting or aren't creating a sense of welcoming for other bodies. And in a way that I feel really tied to or engaged with is this desire to really dispel fear around disability and debility, which are slightly different, right? This is really reductive, but the global and historical discrimination of disability for me has been rooted in individuals' fear of their own disability, or fear of their own debility or own sense of lack in proficiency or efficiency of capacity, and the mirror of this imagery being the impetus for their cruel acts. And so, I mean, with the relationship to medical model and social model of disability or models of disability, it is to assuage this version of like, I will soon be that way. You know, because in essence, we're just trying to make people comfortable with the possibility that they might be using a wheelchair or have lack of sight or be neurodivergent. And so disability always becomes kind of this like, it's okay, you know, or you'll be fine. And so I think to the point of like some people's lack of invitation or toward disability, it's rooted in their own, it's rooted really in their own anger around having to dispel other people's myths, you know, or dispel cultural myth. They're like, I just want to be me. I mean, my invitation is really because I have a personal desire to see people free and see people not confused and see people, you know, with clarity. That's what I want for people in general. And I just try to create environments that happens. With bioethics, shout out to Rosemary Garland Thompson, who's an amazing scholar out of Emory. She's independent. She's doing her thing. She's a disabled cultural writer and is doing a bioethics PhD with emphasis on disability and actually the church, and its reference to, oh my gosh, Abrahamic principles of wholeness. So like, for example, like I said, when you come out of the womb, you're already whole. And so bioethics has this relationship to why are things, what's just about environments. Bioethics, in my nascent view, is a relationship to how we can create justice for the body.
Thank you for listening to episode 68, Act 1 of Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy, Jerron Herman, Pockets of Light. Join us next time for Act 2. This podcast is edited and produced by Ben Weber. Christopher Totten is the director of creative content. Jonna Waldman wrote and performed the theme song. Tim Palin designed the logo. Visit us at www.teachingartistry.org and head to the pod shop at the top of the page for merch. Find us on Instagram at Teaching Artistry Podcast and on YouTube. Check out the Teaching Artistry with Courtney J. Boddy channel and watch We Can't Go Back. Like our page on Facebook, listen to us on SoundCloud and Spotify, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to share this podcast with all the teaching artists in your life.
Let's start it up now. Let's start it up now. Ooh.